Okay, so our topic for tonight is the life of Isaac Leeser, who was the leading traditionalist clergyman among the Jews of the United States for the bulk of the 19th century. And his life is a topic worth exploring because he was a one-man show, and he was the first to do many important things, not necessarily of an institutional nature, but in terms of contributing to the religious life of our people, as I'll explain. So who was he? Where did he come from? And how did he make it to the United States? Well, Isaac Leeser was born in Prussian Westphalia on December 12, 1806. And sadly, he became an orphan at a pretty early age. His mother died in 1814 when he was 7, and his father died when he was 13 in 1820. He received a traditional education, but limited cheder education, limited in the sense that because he was orphaned, the family needed him to work, and he didn't have an opportunity to have as extensive religious training as he would have wanted. When he was 14 years old, he was enrolled in the Munster Academy, which had previously been recognized as a university, but by that point was dumbed down to the level of like a high school, a gymnasium, where he studied for 4 years between 1820 and 1824, and he studied German language and Latin and mathematics and some science. So he had a grounding in secular studies. Simultaneously with that, he studied Talmud with Rabbi Abraham Sutro in the local yeshiva. I wouldn't call it a yeshiva, like a Talmud Torah. And what masechtas did he learn? So we know he learned Baba Kama, Baba Basra, a little Baba Metzia, Simchulin, and Kiddushin. So not the whole Shas, nowhere even near it. And also, very importantly, he did not study Halacha. He did not study Shulchan Aruch. This was not training in Halachic literature for the sake of ordination. So the man is not going to be ordained as a rabbi. And that plays an important role in his life later on. He will always acknowledge that he has no halachic training and that he is not a rabbi. If you contrast that with his fellow Jewish clergymen in America in the mid-19th century, some of them were real rabbis, but others were essentially fraudsters who claimed rabbinic ordination when in fact they had none. So Isaac Leeser was at least honest about his credentials and made the most of what limited training he actually had. So he was also always willing to defer to people who had greater religious learning than he did. Sometimes that's a difficult thing for people to do. They always want to pretend as though or portray things as though they are the wisest in the room and they have the greatest credentials. Leeser was open not only about what he did or didn't have, but if he came across someone who was of more scholarly status than he was, he would defer to them. So at the age of 17, he's a penniless orphan, and it's time for him to make something of his life. So he leaves Germany. Where does he go? He has a maternal uncle named Zalman, who lives in Richmond, Virginia, of all places, in the United States. Jews had been coming from Central Europe to the United States already from colonial times, and there had been a Kehillah in Richmond since the late 1780s. And his uncle was a well-to-do fellow in Richmond. So he takes the boat and he arrives on the scene. And Isaac Leeser spends 10 weeks after his arrival in the United States going to a private school to learn English. And he's a quick learner and he very rapidly masters the English language. But then the school closes and it's time for him to earn some kind of a parnassa. So he becomes an accountant in his uncle's business. He works in the accounting rooms of this firm for 5 years, from 1824 to 1829. Alongside that, he serves as an assistant chazan to the synagogue in Richmond. Bear in mind, the synagogue in Richmond was a Spanish-Portuguese, a Sephardic-style synagogue, and this is where Isaac Leeser, a good Yekke, a good Ashkenazic Jew, learns the methods and styles of prayer of another culture within Judaism. He also teaches in the Talmud Torah in the local shul on Shabbos and on Sundays, to give the kids a little bit of a Yiddishkeit, a little Judaic background. Because Isaac Leeser, at the age of 18, 19, 20, is more learned than the overwhelming majority of American Jews from his limited instruction in Talmudic learning back in Europe. In 1828, Leeser made a name for himself by writing an article in the Richmond Whig. I spell Whig not W-I-G, but W-H-I-G, like the political party, the Whig party. It was a response to articles that were written in London publications, which issued various calumnies against Jews. So anti-Semitic canards were being spread by writers in England, and it was being read in the United States. And so Leeser wanted to engage in some Jewish self-defense in the realm of the public intellectual sphere. So he wrote an article to defend the Jewish people. It was very well received by the Jewish community in America, and it gave him some renown in 1828. A year later, in 1829, the position of Chazan in Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia was available. Why? Because the previous Chazan, Yisrael Keys, died. And so the job was open. And they were taking resumes. It's unclear if Isaac Leeser actually wanted this job. But a friend of his, Mordechai Jonas, from Richmond, he put Leeser's hat into the ring, suggested him as a potential candidate, and the search committee interviewed Leeser, and they liked him, and they gave him the job. This was 1829. Isaac Leeser was a 22-year-old young man, a bachelor, and by the way, he would remain unmarried for his entire life. He never had a family. They hired him, thinking that he was just another chazan who was going to lead the davening in Hebrew and maybe serve in some other eclectic kolbo capacities, as was the style of the time for a chazan. But they didn't think that they were hiring for themselves a prominent figure in American Judaism who was going to rise to the top. They figured he was just going to be some kid who's a religious functionary, davens for the Yomud. But Isaac Leeser had greater ideas for himself and for the community at large than just leading the services in Hebrew. And so tonight I'll examine how he's involved in the Protestantization of American Judaism. That in many ways he wants to transform Judaism in the cultural style, the trappings of American Protestantism, all the while maintaining absolute fidelity to the doctrines of Jewish orthodoxy. In other words, a modernized orthodoxy that fits the American scene. Well, what are some of the things that he does that is mimicking the Protestant ways? So there are four things that stand out. One was his emphasis on the vernacular sermon, preaching, that whereas previously it was not the standard practice for there to be a regular sermon delivered in the American synagogue every Saturday, he wants to make it so. In truth, Gershom Mendesatius, the chair of Israel of New York, had already been doing that, and he was an exception among the colonial and early national era chazanim, in that he became a prominent figure in his own right. But most of the synagogues and most of the chazanim did not sermonize, at least at that point, and were just rendering the prayers in Hebrew and maybe a little bit of English. So Leeser believes that the sermon is not the be-all and end-all, but of critical importance. Why? Because it's the way to convey important lessons in Judaism to the otherwise illiterate audience, that you want them to become learned in whatever facets of the religious tradition you can convey to them, but if you don't do it, they'll never know it. They'll never learn it. Was this an innovation that had no precedent? Well, clearly there was some precedent, at least in New York, but also there was precedent in Europe, in the sense that the early phases of the Reform movement in the 18-teens and in 1820s, there were those progressive rabbis in Central Europe and Western Europe who were doing sermons, and even some traditional rabbis, we might call Orthodox rabbis, in Germany were already giving the sermon, including Abraham Sutro in Munster. So that's one idea of Leeser's, the sermon. Another point is that the chazan should be transformed from just being the renderer of prayers, the shliach tzibur, the baal tefillah, into a Jewish minister, that just as the Protestants have their clergymen, so too the Jews should have their clergymen. What will be the contours of the job of the Jewish clergyman? We'll have to see. The third thing, which is borrowed from the Protestants, is the Sunday school. He's the inventor of the Sunday school, together with Rebecca Gratz in 1838 in Philadelphia. Why is Sunday school? Well, because the day school, which is much preferred, was not really a viable option. There was insufficient interest in that. And so if you're going to give the kids any instruction, it's going to have to be on a less frequent basis than 5 or 6 days a week. So one day a week, Sunday, imitating the heathens is the way to go. And the fourth thing that Leeser did, which was borrowing from the Protestant style, was an English translation of the Bible, which he will write on his own in the 1840s and 1850s. Okay. So Leeser was a tremendous figure in American Jewish public life because he was the first to do many important things. Things that we might take for granted now as existing, but did not necessarily exist before his time. So one thing is, nowadays, it's common practice for rabbis or rabbinical groups to publish a sermon manual. You know, everybody tries to get their copy of the RCA sermon manual, Rabbi Soloveitchik's sermons, Rabbi Lamb's sermons, this sermon manual, that sermon manual, and they steal it for the high holidays and nobody gives a fresh sermon. Okay? So what did he do? He published in 1837 the first ever Jewish sermon manual. The question was asked, were shiurim given to congregants in that era? The answer is shiurim in the sense of with Mara Makomos, with the in-depth style of Talmudic and halachic learning, absolutely not. Were there adult education lectures? Even that, not so much. Leeser would be at the forefront of doing that. Okay. The next thing that Leeser did was an American translation of the Sephardic Siddur, the first ever, 1838. It was not the first ever English translation of the Sephardic Siddur that had already been done in England for the Jewish community in London at the Bevis Marks synagogues. However, this was the first one done in the United States. Then, in 1838, he wrote the first ever Hebrew primer for children for the Talmud Torah. What was important about this? Well, prior to him writing that, the instructions in the Hebrew schools belonging to the synagogues, they didn't have proper material. They didn't have literature. So they had to borrow from the Christians. And they would cut and paste. And they would excise the theologically objectionable passages in what was Christian Sunday school material with Bible stories and make it kosher for the Jews. That's terrible. We should have our own literature. And so he wrote it, 1838. Next thing that he did, which was a first, was an American Jewish newspaper / magazine. There had been an attempt in the 1820s by Samuel Jackson, not Samuel L. Jackson, but Samuel Jackson, was called The Jew, which lasted for about 2 years and was a defense against anti-Semitism and missionary work. But Isaac Leeser was the first one to put forth a regular publication. It was called The Occident and the American Jewish Advocate. Now, the name alone should say something. The Occident and the American Jewish Advocate. What does that tell you? What does that name tell you? Anybody want to guess? So what does American Jewish Advocate tell you?
Defense of anti-Semitism.
Good. So American Jewish Advocate means defense against anti-Semitic canards and vigorous assertion that Jews have a right to play a role in society, that we're not just on the margins and to be dismissed as irrelevant, but rather we're going to advocate aggressively for our rights and our cause. Okay. But the Occident, what does Occident mean? Occident.
Western.
Western, good. So it's Occident as opposed to Orient, that this Judaism is not going to be a backward Judaism of the old world. It's going to be a Judaism which is suitable and fitting for life in the Occidental world. Okay. This magazine lasted, it was a monthly publication, and it lasted for 26 years, of which for 25 years, Leeser was the editor and publisher, and it survived 1 year after he died and closed up shop in 1869. There would be other newspapers that would become his competitors, notably Isaac Meir Wise, the Israelite, or later the American Israelite, and Die Deborah, which was the German version of Isaac Meir Weiss's publication, that would start in 1854 when he would move to Cincinnati. But for a good decade at least, Leisure's was the only one, only game in town, and it was a quality publication. Okay. The next thing that he did, which was a first, was in 1845, he founded an American Jewish Publication Society. Bear in mind, this is not JPS. JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, is founded in 1888 and still exists ad hayom hazeh, till this very day. Leisure's was of the same name, basically, but it was not a non-profit outfit like it is today. It was essentially just his private business. He was the publisher. He owned the entity, and it existed largely to publish his own materials. It ceased to exist because in 1851, the building had a fire, and all the galley proofs and everything went up in smoke and was destroyed, and that was the end of the business. But for at least for a good few years, it put out quality materials. Okay. In 1848, Leisure translated into English the first ever American English translation of the Ashkenazic Siddur. You know, remember, he's himself an Ashkenazic Jew. Ashkenazic Jews are becoming, were the majority of Jews in America when he got there, and are becoming the dominant force in American Jewish life as the years go by. So there is a need for English translation of the Ashkenazic Siddur. Then in 1849, he establishes the first ever Hebrew high school in America. It wasn't much of a success. It only had a few students, and it folded shortly thereafter, but at least it was an attempt to give kids, post-bar mitzvah kids, some kind of religious instruction. Then in 1853-54, he put out his translation of the entire Hebrew Bible in what was a little bit of a stilted English. Okay. Then in 1859, he establishes the first ever Jewish Defense Organization. It was known as the Board of Delegates of American Israelites. The name and concept were essentially stolen, borrowed from the Board of Delegates of British Jews, Board of Deputies of British Jews, which was the leading lay organization of English Jewry and had real power on the other side of the ocean. What was the proximate cause for Leisure to establish the Board of Delegates in 1859? So what event happened a year before that was an anti-Semitic episode of world significance? Who knows? Somebody should know the answer to this.
There Dreyfus? Was
a, huh?
Dreyfus?
No, no, no. You're that's off by 40 years.
The Mortara case.
The Mortara case. Bingo. Mortara okay. Case. The Mortara case was the second major event of an anti-Semitic nature that led Western Jewry into some frenzy that convinced them they had to act. The first one was the Damascus blood libel in 1840, which got people busy. And the Mortara case in 58, again, made West Occidental Jews aware of the fact that they had to be on guard to defend the interests of their Oriental brethren. Okay. And the last first that we could credit to Isaac Leisure is the establishment of a Jewish theological seminary. Not the Jewish Theological Seminary, JTS, but rather a Jewish theological seminary. It was known as Maimonides College. It was established a year before he died in 1867, and it only had a handful of students. And it folded a few years afterwards in 1873. Alan Penn is asking, how come this MVP isn't more famous? So I'm going to try to explain why that's the case. You're right, he is an MVP. He deserves to be in the pantheon of American Jewish heroes. Okay. Well, what happened in his career, and why didn't he get the kind of kavod posthumously that he might have deserved? So, in the early national period, American Judaism was institutionally and intellectually very weak, very weak. It was an orthodoxy of salutary neglect, which is a fancy way of saying orthodox by accident. In other words, people come to the country and they don't have alternative theological leanings other than whatever they absorbed as a kid, but they're not especially active in perpetuating the religion. So to the extent that they do anything, it reflects the old world style, but with decreased fervor. And for that matter, decreased intensity, it's not as important. It's not as a dominant feature of their lives. It takes a certain willingness to reform before you can have immigrant orthodoxy cease to exist. Okay. But in the Second Great Awakening in America, there was a demand for the strengthening of Judaism too. If Christianity is going to be bolstered by newfound fervor, do the same for Judaism. And Lieser understood that. It's time for someone to step up and try to bring people some Yiddishkeit and make sure the religion just doesn't die. So Lieser was influenced by the various Protestant denominations. And most significantly, he was influenced by the Episcopal Church in Virginia and Philadelphia, where he lived. He shared with the Episcopals the preference and the sensibility for the high church. He liked the high church, not the shtiebel, but the high church, the grand synagogue, the big cathedral synagogue, the big sermon from on high. He also shared with the Episcopalians the interest in an organizational model of a national ecclesiastical structure. In other words, a bishopric and a ranking of clergy. How does that play itself in Judaism? Well, he wanted there to be a Beit Din in America, a rabbinical court, and he was an Anglophile, and he liked the system of British Orthodoxy, a system where there's a chief rabbi, there's a Beit Din, and there are ministers underneath the chief rabbi, but there's a clear hierarchy, and everyone is beholden to the system and not operating independently. He had relations, correspondence with prominent British Jews, notably Moses Montefiore, and the various chief rabbis, including Solomon Herschel and Nathan Marcus Adler. So he liked that high synagogue style. Now, to save Judaism, he believed it would have to become more consciously and selectively Americanized rather than unconsciously and unthinkingly and unselectively acculturating. So the laity, when you leave them in control of everything, they're going to Americanize in a haphazard way, in a way that may be detrimental to the cause of Judaism. Whereas if someone who put some thought to it decides we're going to acculturate this way, but not that way, certain aspects of American religious life we're going to blend in other areas we're going to retain our distinctiveness, if it's thought through, maybe Judaism could live. And who's going to think it through? Guys like him, who know what he's talking about. Okay. Lieser developed a Protestant, bibliocentric view of Judaism. The Bible as the main element of instruction. We should not think that he was a Karaite, or that there's a Karaism lurking beneath his bibliocentric view of religion. Not at all. What he means, though, is that the only source of religious truth, the only source of religious truth is the historical revelation at Mount Sinai. In other words, the Bible as we have it is the product of divine revelation, historical divine revelation, as opposed to some sort of bogus continuous revelation theory, and that the rabbis correctly applied the biblical lessons in the Mishnah and Talmud, and that the hermeneutical principles and the exegetical principles of the rabbis are not some far-fetched exegesis, but rather are the correct interpretation of the Bible. He is a firm believer in the various doctrines that came to be considered dogmatic in rabbinic Judaism, Biyat HaMashiach, the Messianic arrival, Kibbutz Galuyot, the ingathering of the exiles. He's not rejecting any of that stuff. He firmly believes in and wants others to believe in the traditional doctrines. Okay. Well, I said he espoused his viewpoints in the sermon. The sermon was something that the public only reluctantly allowed him to give. He started his job in Philadelphia, Mikveh Israel, 1829. In 1830, he gave his first sermon. He gave them on sufferance for the next 13 years, from 1830 to 1843. on sufferance means that he didn't have a right by dint of his contract to give a weekly sermon. It's that if the people put up with it, they would let him do it. But they could have stopped it at any time. Only from 1843 and onward was it codified in his contract that he is entitled to and expected to give a weekly address. The people put up some resistance at first, and even after they let him do it, it wasn't especially popular. He wasn't encouraged in this matter. And the reason he wasn't encouraged is because his sermons were 45 minutes long, copying the style of the Protestant preachers, and he wasn't a great orator. So if it's 45 minutes and it's boring, who wants to listen to that? The question, what about the population of Sabbath observance? The answer is it was on steep decline. In the synagogues that were veering off to reform in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, it was very weak. In the synagogues that maintained their immigrant-style orthodoxy through the mid-century, although most of them eventually went reform too, the Sabbath observance was much stronger. Seth asks, was there a rabbi for the synagogue? The answer is no. There was no rabbi in Mikveh Israel. There was no rabbi in America, period, until 1840. And even after 1840, most synagogues only had preachers, not rabbis. It's not until the Eastern European rabbis come in large numbers in the, after 1880 that you have a significant number, but those are Yiddish speakers. As for Americanized rabbis, you have to wait until Hebrew Union College will pump them out, and their first graduating class is 1883, which we'll talk about with the Trefa Banquet. Okay, so he was not a talented orator, but it should be noted that his sermons read very well as literature. So nobody wanted to listen to it in the pews, but many, many people enjoyed reading it after it was put on paper. And so his sermon manual sold very well all around the country. It was good. There's a difference between a good sermon and a good literature. Okay. Leiser wanted the Chazan to become a minister. Well, in some ways, the law of the land facilitated this. For example, in New York. In New York, in the colonial period and early Republican period, only two classes of people were allowed to solemnize marriages recognized by the state. One was a justice of the peace. The other was a minister of religion. Well, if you don't want to go to a justice of the peace and you want to have a Jewish ceremony, then if it's going to count, you have to have a minister of religion. So, lo and behold, the chazan, who's the most educated Jew there is in town, even though he doesn't know all that much, we're going to declare him to be a minister of religion. Was there a list of kosher butcher locations so as to know where to settle? The answer to that is the various kihilot, the various synagogue communities, would often supply kosher meat in the earliest decades. By the mid-19th century, there were people who were engaged in purveying kosher meat who were not affiliated with any synagogue, and you had to just trust their say-so. There was no hashkacha back then as we would have today. But where did these people advertise so that they would know to have customers? So in part, they could advertise in the Occidental American Jewish Advocate, Isaac Leiser's newspaper. There were ads for all sorts of religious functionaries, including shochtim and the purveying of kosher meat. Okay, so the idea of the chazan as a minister, they said in part was facilitated by the law of the land, but also because Jews wanted to have someone to represent them in civic functions, just as the Protestants and Catholics have their ministers and priests. So the Jew has his chazan. And over time, the various chazanim took on this persona of the minister. But what Leiser wanted was for these ministers to have some skill set, some training. And a theological seminary that he would found at the end of his life, and which would come into being after his death in various permutations, reform and conservative variety, he wanted those places to exist so that the person who goes out there into the world and functions as a minister is identifiable as someone with credentials and not just a charlatan. Because there were plenty of people who really were charlatans, and they claimed all sorts of credentials that they didn't have, and just tried to get away with it because the laity didn't know any better. As long as you're one step ahead of the laity, you know, you could get away with a lot. Okay. Well, He worked with Rebecca Gratz to establish the Sunday school, as I said. He wanted the day school to take off because you can't really be a functioning synagogue Jew who knows how to lead the prayer services and read the Torah and just beyond the realm of liturgy. You can't function in a manner which is required by the halakha unless you have a substantial body of knowledge. And Sunday school education alone really is insufficient. But beggars can't be choosers. A half a loaf is better than no loaf at all. And so he goes the Sunday school route. Why was it successful where the day school failed? It was successful because on Sunday, the people were available to go to school. In other words, businesses had shut down. The regular school, if there was a public school in that area, was not operating. So this was the day of the week when it really was possible to corral the kids and give them some kind of a Jewish education. Okay. Isaac Leiser wanted his Bible to be the Jewish successor to the King James Version, the KJV. We as Jews don't know too much about the King James Version because it's just not our Bible. But you should be aware that the KJV is a big deal, okay? Written between 1605 and 1611, issued by the King of England. It is it's a masterpiece. It's a work of great art, of literature, and it stood the test of time. There is a new King James Version, which came out in the last few decades, that tries to clean up the language where it's too archaic, but it's a really good Bible translation. Granted, it has Christological overtones in certain controversial passages where Jews would disagree with the meaning as the KJV has it, but everyone recognized it as the standard, the standard. So Leiser wanted his Bible to be on that level. In truth, it wasn't that good of a translation. It was a hodgepodge. It was a collection of different prior translations that he put together, and he did his best, but it wasn't all that impressive. Despite not being all that impressive, Asher says it was the first printed in English, and the James Bible helped the Reformation. Right, so that's true. So the Leiser's Bible, for whatever its drawbacks, it nonetheless came to dominate the American synagogue scene. That every shul, regardless of religious denomination, wanted to have an English language chumash available to its parishioners. And so from the 1840s through the 19 teens, the Leiser Bible was everywhere. And I have a few copies here in my office that people, you know, they don't want anymore. They think it's going to go into Seamus, but I hold on to a copy or two just because it's a keepsake. Why was the Leiser Bible eventually replaced? Well, the answer is because the Jewish Publication Society in 1917 issued the old JPS version. And the old JPS version sold many, many, many copies. And then the Hertz Chumash took as its translation the 1917 JPS. And the Hertz Chumash became the real successor to Leiser in that all the Orthodox and conservative synagogues and even some Reform synagogues used the Hertz Chumash. In my view, the Hertz Chumash is our version of the King James. It's Le'elo, Le'elo, Mikol Berchasa V'Shirasa. It's the best of the best. Granted, the Orthodox shuls of today have replaced it with the stone Chumash. In my view, that was a big mistake because you're replacing true literature with what is not really literature. And the conservative synagogues replaced the Hertz Chumash with the Yetz Chaim, which I don't like because it's doctrinally off the derech, whereas Hertz was a real traditionalist. Okay, so that's just the history of Chumashim in synagogues in America. But Leiser was the main Chumash for a long, long time. Okay. As it turned out, the Leiser Bible came in two versions. There was the earlier version, which had some commentary on the bottom, most of which was just a comparison of various translations. It wasn't a digest of Mefarshim, so much as it was, well, this verse doesn't mean this, it doesn't mean that, and this translation says this, this translation says that. But the second version of the Leiser Bible, which was the one which was used in most synagogues, had almost nothing below the fold. Very few notes. It's mostly just the text, the word, capital W, the word in the Protestant sense of the word on the page. the Bible without embellishment. And that's also part of the Protestantization of American Judaism. You have the Bible alone, as opposed to the Catholics who don't want you to read the Bible at all. The Protestants want to encourage you to be proficient in Bible, and Leeser, along the same lines, wants you to read the Bible. Okay. Even Eastern European Jews, who started coming in large numbers in the last third of the 1800s, and especially after 1881, even Eastern European Jews reprinted the Leeser Bible. So, for example, Hebrew Publishing Company from the Lower East Side, which is now defunct, but was a big deal for, you know, many decades in the early part of the 20th century, the Hebrew Publishing Company put out its Chumash with the Leeser translation. Okay. Now, over time, certain things that were innovations done by Leeser became widely accepted. So, for example, the Sunday school, as I said, it was a success where day schools had failed. But it wasn't just a success in Leeser's hometown of Philadelphia. It became the standard practice for all the heterodox synagogues, well, especially the Reform, for the next 100 years or more. Also preaching, something which Leeser faced some hesitation on the part of his congregants, but it became widely accepted. And it would be unheard of in an Americanized synagogue to have a clergy person and yet to refuse them the right of the pulpit. There may be some limitations on what they can say from the pulpit. Okay, it may not be free, in the sense of like the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue of free, you could say whatever you want. There may be some censorship, but the notion that the chazan or the minister, whoever it is allowed to, and in fact is expected to preach, that took on absolutely. Okay. What about this creation of a Jewish ministry? In this regard, Leeser's efforts did not prove immediately successful. What am I talking about? Well, in the 1850s, it was a rough time to be a clergyman in America for you, if you were a Jewish clergyman. All the big names lost their jobs. Isaac Leeser, 21 years Mikveh Israel in Philly, fired. Despite being the leading Jew in America, the leading Jewish intellectual or activist or tumbler, you know, he's doing all these great things, and yet the shul fires him. Why? Because really, they never expected any of this stuff. They just wanted a guy to daven for the Yomud, and they never changed their tune on that. They didn't want him to do all these side activities. And so they fired him after 21 years. He lost his job. Isaac Mara Wise lost his job. He lost his job in Albany. He got into a fist fight with the president of the shul and had to form a breakaway synagogue. And then he left that synagogue and go to Cincinnati. But next week we'll talk about that at length, because we're going to talk about the rabbis of the 1850s. Were there itinerant Jewish preachers? The answer is not too many. There were a handful, but usually they settled down at some point and took a pulpit. Because the notion of the itinerant darshan, which was a popular thing in Europe, never really was popular in America among the early waves of American Jewry. Later, after 1881, and you have 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, when you have on the Lower East Side, you have darshanim, who will, for a shekel or two, will give you a nice drasha. So in the Eastern European wave, the itinerant darshanim are back just because that culture was familiar with it and accepted it. But we're way before that, and the itinerant preacher was not much of a factor. Okay, so Max Lilienthal was fired from his job in New York and also ends up in Cincinnati. Leo Merzbacher of Temple Emmanuel wasn't fired, but was almost fired. Abraham Rice was the rabbi in Baltimore. He was so disgusted with his job and was on the verge of being fired that he left to go into the dry goods business. So when did the first Hasidic Rebbe come to America? Moshe is asking. The answer to that, I believe, is the Kapishnitzer in 1926, who established his court on 247 East Broadway on the Lower East Side. And then the next one, I believe in the 30s, there was some minor Rebbe who lived in Brooklyn. And then in 1940, the Friedrich Rebbe Lubavitch came. And then after that, a whole lot more, obviously. Okay, so why were all these clergymen being fired? So the answer is simple. The laity runs the show. There isn't a culture of deferring to the prerogatives of the rabbi, as though the rabbi has some great ecclesiastical power and represents the word of the Almighty. No, the rabbi's an employee, and if we don't like what he's doing, he's fired. Okay. So it was a rough go in Leiser's lifetime. In 1857, his friends among Philadelphia Jewry decided to establish a new shul for him, Congregation Beth El Emet, and he was the preacher, he was the chazan of that synagogue from 1857 until his death in 1868. But that's just because he had a handful of, you know, chassidim, so to speak, or talmidim, who liked him and wanted him to have a position. But it was easy to lose your position. It was not until the late 19th century when there was really an established American-speaking Jewish clergy, rabbinate. And that's the result of Isaac Meir Wise's graduates who formed the CCAR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis. Isn't that still true vis-a-vis the board of directors versus rabbis? Well, it's true in the sense that, yeah, the rabbi is an employee, but there is much greater deference accorded to the rabbi in 20th or 21st century American Jewish life, as opposed to the chazan slash minister of 150 years ago. Okay. So when Leiser died, he was eulogized by one of his disciples, Meyer Sulzberger, who would go on to become a major judge and a collector of Judaica and a scholar in his own right. And he compared Leiser to Moses Mendelssohn. Moses says nobody since Moses Mendelssohn has had accomplished so much to modernize Judaism within the bounds of tradition. But the truth of the matter is that Sulzberger was wrong. Moses Mendelssohn was an intellectual. And yes, they both wrote translations of the Bible. Mendelssohn's Biur was a translation into the German, although it wasn't exactly like Leiser's translation. Leiser was an English font, Roman characters, English language, whereas Mendelssohn's Biur was in Hebrew font into German without the heathen characters. And also Mendelssohn's Bible was a perush on the bottom, in Tivod HaShalom, whereas Leiser really didn't have a perush, didn't have a commentary. So what was Leiser? He was not a great, profound thinker. He was not the leader of a denomination or the founder of a denomination. He was a doer. He did things that were necessary to keep traditional Judaism afloat in terms of publications, establishing organizations, and advocating on behalf of Jewry. But you're not going to read his literature and find great chidushim, great novelty. Not going to happen. So Leiser's congregants discouraged him from his various side activities, as I mentioned. They not only resisted his sermonizing, but even Rebecca Gratz, who cooperated with him on the Hebrew school, on the Sunday school, told him, don't publish your books. There's no reason for you to publish your books. Now, a rabbi or a preacher who wants to publish books and is told, you shouldn't bother, that's very discouraging and very deflating. I mean, right now I'm in the midst of trying to publish two books with Geffen Publishing, and Mirza Shem will come out, you know, in the next couple of months. But if you tell me to stop halfway through, I'd throw a fit. You know, I'm working so hard, I'm trying to put this out. What do you tell me not to do it for? And yet Rebecca Gratz told him, don't. Why did she tell him not to? Well, she thought the writing was poor. Simple as that. She didn't think there was an audience for it, that it was unimpressive quality. And yet, in fact, Leiser's writings did sell quite well and are still available today. Nobody's reading it because it's not exactly the most impressive of stuff, but in its time, it was needed. For a community that had nothing else, they needed Leiser's literature. Okay. But nobody would publish his stuff. He had to function as his own publisher, business manager, proofreader, salesman, and agent because he couldn't find a cooperative publishing house. This is not a surprise, after all. I mean, what Gentile publishing house is interested in producing Jewish literature? Maybe, you know, Bamberg in Venice in 1521 is putting out the Talmud because it's the first time ever that rabbinic literature is coming out. But in America of the 1830s, 40s, 50s, nobody's interested in taking a chance on this material. So he does it himself. And he's basically successful at it. He doesn't go broke. He just has a problem because there was a fire, so he has to shut down his operations for a while. One of the reasons why, and getting back to Alan's question of how the MVP of American Judaism of the 19th century did not achieve renown, is because he served the Sephardim. The Sephardim and not the Ashkenazim. He was personally an Ashkenazic Jew, a German Jew, but he served the Sephardic community. And we understand at this point that the Sephardic element within the community is declining. They are no longer the dominant force. The days when Mikveh Israel and Sherith Israel and Beit Elohim of Charleston were Spanish-Portuguese synagogues that dominated the American Jewish scene, that is long since come and gone by the time that Leiser is active in the 1840s, 50s. Okay, so had he been the leader of an up-and-coming synagogue rather than a declining kehillah, maybe his renown would have been greater, and for posterity, things would have been different. But also, there's another factor. It's that he was a traditionalist who was unwilling to compromise on doctrinal issues, whereas the community as a whole is moving further and further away from tradition and adopting reform. So it's almost inevitable that the leader of that charge of reform, Isaac Meir Wise, the great charlatan, who was a phony rabbi, he would become the famous one and the hero of the great masses of Jewry. And that Leiser would be not forgotten, but certainly not remembered to nearly the same extent. Okay, so Leiser had called for a synagogue union, a clergy union, and a school for ordaining Jewish ministers. And yet, it was Isaac Meir Wise who founded, in quick succession, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations in 1873, the Hebrew Union College in 1875, and the CCR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, in 1889. So all three entities that Isaac Leiser had anticipated could exist and should exist, and he attempted to create some of them, but without success, all those would be successfully achieved by his colleague slash competitor slash adversary, Isaac Meir Wise. Okay, but it should be noted that Leiser did influence some disciples, and those disciples did found the Jewish Theological Seminary and the Jewish Publication Society and the United Synagogue of America. So it's not as though he was a failure completely. It's that the institutions which would go on to have great success in the century to follow were founded not by him, but by the generation later, people who respected him. Okay. In his time, you know, in his lifetime, Leiser was the most respected American Jew, even more so than Isaac Meir Wise. And bear in mind why. Because Leiser died in 1868, and the shift to reform, although it was ongoing in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, would not really reach a crescendo and a high point until the late 1860s, early 1870s. And at that point, Leiser was dead. So in his lifetime, if you had a new shul that was being formed in on a frontier town, and you wanted an important Jew to come and give the drasha at the Chanukah Sabayis, at the inauguration of the synagogue, who did you call? Not Ghostbusters. You called Isaac Leiser. You call Isaac Leiser, and you write a letter to him in Philadelphia, and he shows up in Memphis or wherever, or Chattanooga or Tuscaloosa, and he gives a little drasha at the founding of your shul, because he was the most respected of all the American Jews in terms of religious leadership. Okay. He never married. So why did he never marry? Well, who knows, but it was common knowledge that he was physically ugly. It's a terrible thing to say about a person who's been dead 152 years, that he was physically ugly, but I'm only mentioning it just because even in his own time, it was an obvious thing that he was not a very aesthetically pleasing person. If you look at the pictures, look on Wikipedia, look on Google after I'm done, you'll see no shame upon him. And why did it matter? The fact that he didn't have a family meant that he was able to devote all of his time and a crazy amount of hours to his publications and to do all the things he needed to pump out those books. Because remember, he has nobody working to help him. But also, his physical appearance gave him a certain humility that served him well in the sense that he never got on his high horse and said, I'm the boss, I'm the be-all and end-all, I know everything. He was really a humble man, a humble servant of the Lord, just trying to do the right thing. Okay. One of his great successes was that he convinced Judah Turo to give his estate upon his death to Jewish charitable causes. Now, Judah Turo came from Newport. The Turo Synagogue is named after him. The real name of the Turo Synagogue is Yeshuat Yisrael, but because he bequeathed a fair amount of money to it, it became known as the Turo Synagogue. He was born in Newport. Family was from there. He died in New Orleans. He became a rich man doing business in New Orleans. When he died, his estate was valued at $200,000. $200,000 is a tremendous sum of money. Well, some of that went to Yeshuat Yisrael, which then became known as by his name. Some of it went to established educational institutions in the United States. And some of that money, a substantial amount of that money, came under the control of Moses Montefiore, the great rich British Jew, who then used that money to build what? To build what? Who knows?
Windmill?
Windmill.
Bingo. Good. So the windmill and the Yamin Moshe neighborhood, which is named after Moses Montefiore, using money from Judah Turo. Okay, so what about the Occident, his newspaper? The Occident served many useful purposes, one of which was to create a feeling of coherence and comradeship among American Jews and thereby overcome feelings of isolation resulting from the great geographic distances that separated the communities, which is a mouthful, but it's a nice way of saying that Jews live 1,000 miles apart from each other. You know, you have a Jew in Albany and a Jew in New York City and a Jew in Richmond and a Jew in South Carolina and a Jew on the frontier in the American Midwest. Maybe he's an isolated Jew somewhere in Kentucky or Louisiana. Well, that Jew feels like, I have no community, I'm so far away, I have no Yiddishkeit. Then he gets his monthly copy of The Occident that comes in the mail, and he reads news, he knows about Jewish communities in America, he reads a little essay about Torah. So The Occident served a useful purpose in making American Jewry feel as though they were united and they had one common experience. Also, it covered... as a newspaper, the great denominational debates of the 1850s and 60s, when the champions of reform and the champions of tradition / orthodoxy were duking it out on the pages of his magazine, where he was a partisan. Remember, he's a great traditionalist, but nonetheless, despite his own personal viewpoint, he uses the magazine to be essentially a neutral forum where all parties can share their spiel, and he can then write about the ongoing intellectual ferment. Okay. Also, one of the things that he does is write articles about missionary activity targeting Jews. Remember, the American Jewish Advocate. The Advocate is against anti-Semitism and the missionary work that's being done to try to convert Jews to Protestantism. Okay. Another thing that exists in the Occident is advertisements for rabbinical positions or chazan positions, minister positions. It happens to be that Leiser himself was very actively involved in recommending and for the search committee of many synagogues that needed a chazan / rabbi. So he would offer a seal of approval, you know, a hechsher, so to speak, for a given candidate. Now, if you recall from last week, I mentioned that Gustavo Poznanski was considered a traditional person when he was hired by Beit Elohim in Charleston, South Carolina. It turned out that they were wrong, that he was a reform-minded person. But who gave him a seal of approval? Isaac Leiser. So, you know, just like YU sends out, you know, the notices, such and such a shul is looking for a rabbi, anyone who wants to apply can apply. So the Occident had the same thing. It was like a clearinghouse for job placement. Okay. Leiser was one man who anticipated all the contours of eventual American Jewish communal life. So he anticipated the day schools, theological seminary, citywide federation of philanthropic groups, national boards of rabbis, local boards of rabbis, adult education courses, the sermon, the Sabbath sermon, textbooks for kids in the schools, and support for Eretz Yisrael. So all the things that came to dominate American Jewish communal life, whether religious or Zionistic or philanthropic, he had an idea of what could be done and what should be done, and sometimes was successful in creating institutions that would last and sometimes not, but you know, his heart was in the right place, and his mind already could conceive of what should be the functioning of the community. Now I'm going to end with the following question. Well, should Isaac Leeser be remembered in denominational terms as a modern Orthodox Jew, as a forerunner from modern Orthodoxy, or as a forerunner of conservative Judaism? What do you say?
Conservative.
Why?
Because of the reasons you espoused, which started with a capital E for Episcopalian.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, but...
But, yeah, Tina?
You said in his doctrine, he still believed in Torah Mishamayim.
Good. All right, good.
Departure from the conservative movement.
Okay.
It's not what he says, it's what he does.
I would say at that epoch, it was demorphic. It could have gone anyway.
All right, so let me give you my answer now. Well, first, my father's question. Did the newspaper comment on issues of slavery? The answer is yes. Leeser was opposed to slavery. As a person from Philadelphia, that made sense. Of course, his family down in Richmond may have had a different opinion, but Leeser himself was, by the way, was not such a radical abolitionist. And in fact, there were certain lines that he wrote that were a little bit bigoted. However, he was definitely pro-union and favor, and in the course of the war came to see slavery in a very negative light and wanted to see it abolished. But on the answer of Orthodox versus conservative. So most Orthodox Jews in America never heard of him. Okay, how many of the 62 people listening tonight, some of you who have listened to me for many years, never heard of Isaac Leeser? So he's not recalled, he's not in the list, the roster of Gedolim of American Jewish history, as far as the Orthodox would be concerned. However, the Orthodox are always interested in finding some precedent in an earlier period. And if you go to Art Scroll, 1994, the publication, the book called Torah Lives, it's on the shelf in my parents' house. I remember reading it as a kid. I think they gave it away in the Great Neck Synagogue Simchas Torah one year. Isaac Leeser is listed together with other people like the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Chaim Isaac Grzynski, Major Gedolim. And then you get to the American section and it says Arnold Fischel, who was a chaplain during the Civil War, and Isaac Leeser. And I'm wondering, what is this doing here? It doesn't seem to fit with Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva and the Hasidisha Admorim. Why is Art Scroll writing about Isaac Leeser? The answer is they'd like him to be a forerunner of whatever style of religion they feel is appropriate, even though from a cultural point of view, he has no relationship whatsoever with Eastern European Old World Orthodoxy, not in the least. But as Tina mentioned, on a doctrinal point of view, he definitely doesn't depart from the Anima means. Okay, he's the Maimonidean Creed is right up his alley without any tinkering. Okay, so what about the conservative movement? Would the conservative movement see him as a forerunner? The answer is absolutely yes.
Yeah.
Because his disciples and successor at Mikveh Israel were the founders of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Sulzberger was his leading Talmud, and Meir Sulzberger was a founder of JTS.
Yeah.
Okay. Successor at Mikveh Israel was Sabato Moraes, and Sabato Moraes was the founder and first president of JTS. And was the one who gave smicha to all the first crop of students, including Hertz. So there are direct personal connections in the decade or two after Leeser's death between him and his cohort and the founding of the fountainhead of the conservative movement. So that's why he is more remembered on 122nd Street in Broadway than he ever would be at 185th Street in Amsterdam Avenue, if you get my drift. Okay, so on that note, we'll stop here, and next week we'll discuss the rabbis coming to America. Bye-bye, everybody.